From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with artist and sculptor Red Grooms. His work reflects the confusion and paranoia of modern city life. Also today, I talk with poet Mark Halliday. His first book of poems, Little Star, is inspired by rock and roll and popular culture. Rock historian Ed Ward reviews the career of Steve Cropper, the guitarist who's played for everyone from Sam and Dave to the Blues Brothers. And book critic John Leonard reviews Cloak and Gown, Robin Wink's investigation of how the CIA recruited covert agents at Yale University. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is painter and sculptor Red Grooms. A major retrospective of his work is now on exhibit at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York City. This show includes his best-known piece, Ruckus Manhattan, which, like much of his art, burlesques the pandemonium of city life. Ruckus Manhattan is one of his 3D walkthrough environments, which he calls sculpto-pictoramas. He transforms the gallery into a miniature city in a style inspired by comic books, advertising, and movies. Ruckus has its own crowded subway car, a taxi complete with a fast-talking cabbie, and a 17-foot-high Woolworth building. Wrapped around the building is a dragon with movable wings that is reminiscent of 1950s monster movies. The streets are teeming with Grooms's caricatures of businessmen, shoppers, bag people, pimps, whores, and policemen. Red Grooms once described himself as a contrast to the heavy aesthetic side of art. That attitude may have kept him out of the museum world for many years, but in 1985, the first major museum retrospective of his work was mounted by the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. That touring show and the current exhibit at the Whitney have helped to establish his place in contemporary art. Red Grooms told me that the danger and paranoia of urban life provide inspiration for his comic cityscapes.
When I was in London recently, an English person said that New Yorkers have this fantasy of themselves living in a rough, tough place, always endangered by some threatening evil. And maybe I actually indulged in that, I think, with some of my city pieces. I actually saw the danger and the violence is almost a kind of badge of glamour and so forth for city livers.
The city is the subject of a good deal of your work, though hardly all of it. Do you see your sculptures and sculptor pictoramas and paintings of the city as being a kind of modern equivalent of landscape painting?
Well, let's see. I think I got interested in the crowd, sort of the masses of people as a sort of colorful means to escape the suburbs, really. I was living in the suburbs of Nashville, and I would go uptown sort of usually by myself and go to see films on a Saturday. I'd like to see sometimes a couple films on a Saturday afternoon, but I also enjoyed looking at the people. And I always kind of wished Nashville was a bigger city than it actually was at that time. And I think that desire to really submerge myself in the crowd gave me the desire to move to New York, because finally I really would be in a huge metropolis.
What attracted you to it? Was it the energy, the colors?
I think it was less of an attraction to it than more of a desire to get out of the boredom of the suburbs. I think that I was bored to death in the suburbs. Not so much with my family. I enjoyed my home life. I had a very nice family life, and I enjoyed that. But I think finally, I grew up in the, got out of high school in 55, so I just sort of been through the really heavy Eisenhower years and the really when the so-called square was for real. And I just found it hard to kind of find a place in that atmosphere. There was no place to kind of get comfortable. And I sort of perceived big city life as kind of a place where you could meet something a little richer. And
well, I think some of the first times that you actually lived in the city was when you went to art school, because you went, I know, to the Art Institute of Chicago. And then you went to the New School for Social Research in New York, where you studied with Hans Hoffman. But you dropped out of both schools. Did living in the city appeal to you more than actually going to school?
Yeah, I didn't. I certainly didn't want to have any more scholastic knowledge after I got out of high school. I really wanted to sort of become an artist of some sort and sort of do what I wanted to do. And I did try some odd jobs, and I made so little money. I was only making a dollar an hour no matter what I tried to do. And that was kind of good because I figured I may as well become an artist because even if I made nothing, it wouldn't be much different than making 45 bucks a week. So I sort of took the plunge right away and went for, just went kind of all out for an art career.
Which meant what? I mean, what did you do to start it?
Well, what I really did in New York was turned out to be a pretty good strategy is I opened up my own art gallery. I opened up a gallery called City Gallery on 24th and 6th Avenue, and my friend and advisor was Jay Milder. He was about the same age as me from Omaha, Nebraska. And Jay was one of these fellows that he just was terrific. He had city smarts. He just fit in right away. And I sort of hung on to his coattails and made acquaintances. And things got smoother, you know, from the contact with friends. And having the gallery, we were able to make our work visible, and we had a certain theatrical aspect about our presentations that made people interested.
You also show the work of some now famous artists, right, like Klaus Oldenburg and Jim Dine.
I know. I wish I'd bought some of them or something and kept one around. I remember once I had this crummy bedroom. Absolutely, it was a hole in the wall, and I literally had about 60 Jim Dine gouaches around the wall that he had just given me to put on exhibition. And I didn't keep a one of them. And I also didn't sell a one of them.
Huh. It seems that right from the start, more or less, when you became like an adult artist, that your work was off the canvas, that you took your work off the canvas and didn't want it confined to that. Can you talk about that kind of desire to not have your art just confined to the wall?
Right. Well, there was probably a lot of reasons for it. One of my credos was to finish the painting in sort of one inspirational burst. I mean, I would sometimes work 3-4 hours slopping around and really get into a mess. I mean, I'd be knee-deep in slippery paint tubes, and I'd be covered with paint and sort of desperate, but still wishing I could get an image, get something out of my work. You know, it's a strange piece of work to be standing there getting nowhere after you've been working hard for 4 or 5 hours. So out of desperation, I would take something like a piece of cardboard, or even at one point I took my own shirt and stuck it onto the wet canvas. And so at least I had a dry spot to kind of come to grips with and stop slipping around. So it's kind of out of half practical experience slugging away, and half out of the times, you know, the influence of other artists, and also the work I did, the theatrical work, the happenings. I found out that there was a lot of excitement in going quite aggressive and going toward the audience, sort of literally charging toward the audience.
Did you realize that you had that theatrical bent in you before you started doing the happenings?
Oh, yeah. I always felt quite theatrical and was interested in theatrics from, well, as soon as I saw Pinocchio or something when I was a little kid.
Pinocchio did it, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
I think at one of your happenings you also painted in front of the audience.
Well, I wanted to sort of be a performer, really, and I didn't have much talent as a singer or a dancer, so I had... The only thing I could do was paint, so I figured maybe it's a good act. And I was encouraged in this madness by Dominic Falcone and Yvonne Anderson, who put on the performance in their gallery, the Sun Gallery in Provincetown.
Do you think it was a good act?
I don't know. People are still talking about it, so it must have been pretty good.
What about the painting? Were you satisfied with that?
Yeah, I like it. It looks pretty good. I mean, people can now judge for themselves, but considering it was done in 45 minutes, it's not bad.
What did fine arts appeal to you? And I ask this because, I mean, obviously you were very interested in theater and performance, although, as you said, you know, you weren't really a singer or a dancer. But a lot of your imagery is very pop in, you know, in a lot of ways. And it's ironic and it's funny and it's entertaining in a way that we've come to frequently not expect from the world of fine arts. Did you ever consider going into another form of like the popular arts instead of the fine arts?
Yeah, I was very interested in movie making. As I said, it was sort of the first culture I got in Nashville, and I was watching movies from, I don't know, 8 on. And I was very interested in the inside jobs, like being the director or being the art director, that kind of that aspect of it. And I read a lot about filmmaking. But for some reason, I'm not quite sure why. Maybe I'm underneath it all a little bit introverted, like artists kind of are. And in a way, I maybe, you know, it sort of appealed to me that sort of the fatalisticness of being an artist. Instead of doing something useful, you just do something that's sort of philosophical, really. I mean, it's sort of, you know, you can get from it whatever you want, but it's not necessarily saleable or useful or whatever.
What were the movies that made a really big impression on you when you were young?
Ah, that's a good question. Well, I like the Stanley Kramer movies. Stanley Kramer was a guy who made these kind of tough black and white films. He made a film called The Sniper that was, I like that film very much because there was a spectacular shot of the sniper on a chimney that was shot from about half a mile away, so you get this terrific jump in scale with this tiny figure, big chimney, and a lot of rough-looking sky, dark sky behind him. Things like that. I like that. I like those tough black-and-white pictures, kind of almost B-movies. Then I like all kind of action pictures. I particularly like... this may be the real... reason I do like crowds and kind of big scale work is because my main criteria, what made a movie good, was how big it was. I wanted to see lots of extras, lots of action. That's what I look for.
War movies, biblical epics, things like that.
Exactly,
like?
Yeah.
And you think you're doing the urban equivalent of that with casts of thousands?
Yeah, I think so. I thought it was a good idea to take the city and instead of making it some great moment of history or something, just present it as a great moment of history, even though it's commonplace.
You worked as an usher for a while at the Roxy Theater in New York, which was demolished quite a while ago, as I recall, but if it's the theater I'm thinking of, it was a huge theater with a mezzanine and a balcony. And
Yeah.
Did you have to wear a uniform?
Oh, I sure did. I had a spiffy gray uniform, and I became a supervisor. So I got to wear a silver braid instead of a black braid. I was quite proud of that.
That's one of the things I used to really love about movie going is that there were all these like ceremonial aspects to it. The ushers
yeah,
had uniforms.
Right.
The theater was really enormous. There were great decorations inside.
We were, my generation of ushers were kind of the last of a line of ushers that was started by this guy, Roxy Rothafel, who started the Roxy. And he must have been some kind of ex-Marine or something because he actually had these guys do precision drilling, and he was an absolute fanatic. I mean, we were a bunch of bums compared to those days. You know, we were like 35 years too late. But I was in the last generation of ushers at the Roxy. I was fired, in fact, because a picture called The Windjammer was brought in there, and that was one of these cinoramic pictures. And they had to get union ushers in there, and that's because it was reserve seating. And so all the guys, like myself, were out of the job.
In addition to your movies and your work about movies, you've done several pieces. that are homages to art history, to great paintings, or to great painters. Why is art history an interesting subject for you, as the subject of your work?
Well, I guess I finally, when you get down to it, I like artists and I admire artists, and I guess I'm fascinated by artists, you know, and I don't know. I find it an appropriate subject because I've just been sort of so interested in it for so long.
Some people think that the most tired thing in the world is art about other art because it's so self-absorbed. And I wonder how you react to that.
Yeah, I could see that could be true. Well, I try to see it. When I say I like artists, I don't feel like an artist myself. I don't feel sort of too incestuous about that. I think I sort of remove myself from the profession at that time and try to see it, you know, as an outside person would. And so I don't feel too overbound into the thing about that, because I think artists, you know, they do get out into public life, and people imagine about them as they would politicians or actors or scientists.
Artist Red Grooms is my guest. There's a retrospective of his work now at the Whitney Museum in New York. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
You actually are living in Chinatown in Manhattan now, right?
Right.
Is Chinatown becoming populated by a lot of artists looking for cheap loft space?
What? I think it's totally populated by Chinese. But there may be some artists. Yeah, there's a few artists around. But not in Chinatown itself. I think it's just too many Chinese to make any room for artists.
So you're one of the few artists there.
I'm there because I got the place in 1969, and Chinatown really has moved around the building I'm in. It's really sort of swept past us. Before, it was the immediate neighborhood was basically a machinist neighborhood, and has since become garment manufacturing and noodles, and I don't know what else. Videotapes, Chinese videotapes. We have a lot of that around.
So you've never been plagued by the upscale...
No.
Nature of the areas that artists live in, like artists move into a neighborhood,
right,
and the prices go up.
So far, my neighborhood hasn't changed for the worse. No, it's already at the worst. Sometimes I think I have to be in the running for the ugliest street in the world, and that has not changed. So I have to bear the burden of total brutality all the time, every time I step down on the street. But on the other hand, you know, it hasn't been gentrified.
Well, how ugly is it?
Bad, bad, really bad.
Can you describe it?
Oh, God.
I want to know how ugly it really is.
It's the smell as well as I won't even go into the description of the smell, but, well, sure, sometimes it looks even beautiful, but I think about New York, there's a certain rawness. I was just in Philadelphia for a week and went back to New York for a day, and I already felt like a tourist because the place is just so beat up. It's so sort of mauled or something. And the textures are so germy and overused. And everybody seems, it's like some kind of mad stock car race or something where everybody's trying to go as fast as they can. The only way to protect yourself there is just to go as fast as you can and be aggressive. It's the safest route.
New Yorkers, I think, rationalize New York. It's a profession. I mean, everyone learns how to do it, because New Yorkers think that New York is the craziest place in the world, but they know they live in it, so they find all kinds of wonderful things about it. You obviously like love it and hate it, like
yeah,
so many
true,
New Yorkers
yeah.
do.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And once you've sort of made the effort to adapt, it's kind of hard to live in a nice place because you're sort of suspicious of it. You think, this can't be real living, you know. This is sissy. This can't be.
In your sculpto pictoramas and paintings of the city, there are a lot of different ethnic people in it. And I wonder if some people ever think that your depictions are slightly racist, because in caricaturing the people, you kind of play up certain characteristics that in some people's hands would look kind of racist. So I wonder if that's something that you think about, and if it's something that you've gotten reactions
about.
Well,
I've thought about it recently, because I had a lot of trouble out in Denver with a piece called The Shootout, which was a big outdoor sculpture that the Indians found very offensive, because it depicts a cowboy and an Indian shooting at each other. And there was a big outcry and a lot of things said back and forth. I found it very hard to defend, because I was rather embarrassed by the fact that I had offended the Indian so much. To some extent, certainly not willfully, but also somewhat naively. And that did make me, yes, that made me start thinking about caricature and how it can be an unpleasant tool, really, if you're on the wrong side of it. But I think I was getting worried. I was, because first of all, I don't think you can't think about it too consciously. You have to be a good sort, but go ahead without thinking, I think. Because if it's going to be good, and I was a little afraid that I was going to be terribly messed up, but right away I got back at it. You know, it just sort of came out. Maybe I learned. You know, I'm hoping to learn too, through doing this, and also get a better sense of people. But I think that satire and caricature are good, and I think they should be inclusive. I think everybody should be satired and be included in that kind of response.
You said that everyone should be caricatured and it should be okay. Now, you've done a lot of self-portraits.
Right.
And I wouldn't call them exactly caricatures, but you sure do look different in each one. Do you see yourself as differently from day to day as your self-portraits would reflect?
Well, I was looking at them today. It seems like it's my hairdo that changes a lot, which is true. That does happen. Weight changes, and I guess your state of tiredness and fatigue also is another aspect of how you look when you see yourself. I try to go right straight at myself, too. You know, I try to be impartial when I go at it.
You look very depressed, I think, in some of them.
Some of them, yeah. Some of them. A few of them are very quite personal. You know, I tried to, you know, I just sort of had my back against the wall, and I just, you know, used myself as sort of a sounding board.
Do you have to look in the mirror a lot when you're doing a self-portrait?
I think almost all those are real mirror self-portraits. I think they all are.
How can you stand looking in the mirror for so long? I don't mean like with a face like yours. How can you? But I mean, it's so hard for most of us to look at ourselves for really long stretches of time like that. You just start to see more than you care
you know,
to, I think.
In some sense, I like realism, really. I actually do like realism. And I think one of the stances of a realist is that you are trying to be impartial, that you're really just sort of an eye, and you're just trying to see things through, form and light the way they are.
Well, how impartial can you be with yourself, though?
Well, that's it. I don't know. But, I mean, I was trying to be impartial.
You now have the opportunity to stand in a museum that's surrounded with your life's output from 1956 to 1984. What are some of the things that go through your mind seeing your life work in front of you?
I think mostly at art shows you get into a social mood and just talk to people, you know. I guess to be more specific, though, about how I feel about the art, I think I'm enjoying seeing some pictures and sort of mulling over and thinking about them. They all seem familiar. I mean, 29 years isn't very long, really.
Do you have a desire now to change things in earlier works?
Oh, I used to be terribly embarrassed about early works, but I'm also a bit of a collector, so at this stage I'm sort of, the collector in me has overcome the art critic, so that early works, which I sign Charles Grooms and sometimes Chaz, C-H-A-S period, are to me highly collectible.
I guess that distances you enough from worrying about how they look. Because I know a lot of people don't like to see.
I was terribly embarrassed for a while. You know, you feel like you should somehow be much better than that and all that.
Do you have very, very early work from before 56?
When
you were
a
teenager or a child?
Yeah.
Do you see artistic promise in it when you look back at it?
Not really. I'm amazed I was encouraged at all. That's the strange thing, why anybody would encourage it instead of a no-talent kid in the first place, I don't know.
Did you think of yourself as being no talent?
Well, I think, in a way, because I think the reason I did become an artist was I was kind of a bum at doing almost everything, so that the good thing about being an artist is kind of like soft information, you know, you can do a lot of fudging. So that was just perfect for me.
Did you ever do a piece on your own street, which just a couple of minutes ago you described as being the ugliest block in the world?
Oh, yeah, this alley that's being shown in Europe is just two doors down.
Oh.
And I had lived there, you know, looking at it for some 15-odd years before I finally did it.
So how did you transform it for the piece?
It wasn't hard. I mean, I just sort of, like, followed my instincts and looked at it a lot.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, it's very much kind of like a Dr. Calgary set. The alley sort of looms over you and gives this little crack of a sort of grubby-looking sky over your head. And then it has these pipes sticking out all over the place with steam coming out and these grubby bums warming their hands over a barrel with fire coming out and lots of trucks and loading docks and people silhouetted in these grungy-looking windows and sweatshops. And
God, that sounds great.
That's about it. You know, a lot of texture.
I'd love to see a piece like that on your block. I think that would be really bizarre. Have you ever thought about doing that?
No, I actually like to show things in contrast to the actual setting. In other words, I'd rather do Versailles and put it on my block or something like that and put the alley in Versailles. Not that that would work so well, but some sort of an idea of contrast.
Are you getting that fabulous odor from all the decaying food and garbage on your street into the alley piece?
This piece is made out of foam rubber, and by now, after it's been sitting around in crates for 3 or 4 months, it probably is beginning to create its own odor.
My guest has been artist Red Grooms. The Whitney Museum of Art in New York is currently exhibiting a retrospective of his work. It runs through October 18th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Jay Stevens, whose new book looks at the 40-year history of the hallucinogenic drug LSD. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, poet Mark Halliday reads Little Star, his homage to the 1958 doo-wop hit by The Elegants. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward runs down the career of guitarist Steve Cropper. And John Leonard reviews Cloak and Gown by Robin Winks. This book examines how Yale University became a source of covert agents in the early days of the CIA. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell. The Reagan administration has presented new and less intrusive proposals for inspecting missile facilities on U.S. and Soviet territory. The inspections would be part of a treaty banning intermediate-range missiles on both sides. Details from Barry Schwide.
Officials are calling it a simpler system. They also say inspection would be less frequent, less intrusive, less pervasive. That, they say, is because the two sides decided to ban all medium-range missiles, not just most of them. With no such missiles allowed, the theory goes, there is less likelihood of cheating, and cheating will be easier to spot. Behind the scenes, U.S. officials also acknowledge the revised proposal presented to the Soviets in Geneva took into account the concerns of U.S. intelligence agencies. They simply did not want Soviet inspectors roaming about freely, which would have been their right if U.S. inspectors had free rein in the Soviet Union. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev today proposed that leaders of the 15 nations on the U.N. Security Council discuss how money saved from disarmament could be spent for economic development. Gorbachev made the suggestion through Deputy Foreign Minister Vladimir Petrovsky to an international conference on disarmament and development. The United States has rejected a link between the two ideas and has refused to send a representative to the current conference. The latest convoy of U.S. flag tankers and their naval escorts has been forced to delay its entry into the Persian Gulf. UPI's John Phillips reports.
The U.S. Navy has come up against one of its most persistent enemies in the Gulf, bad weather. High winds have been gusting sand from the Arabian Desert at speeds of up to 25 knots. A heat haze also has reduced visibility drastically. Not for the first time, a northbound convoy of reflagged Kuwaiti tankers has had to be postponed, just as it was about to move through the Strait of Hormuz. Shipping sources say Rear Admiral Harold Burnson, the commander of the Middle East Task Force, can do nothing but wait for the weather to lift before ordering the convoy into the Gulf. John Phillips, Bahrain.
A top Saudi Arabian official today denounced the Iranian regime as a group of terrorists. And Interior Minister Prince Nayef also said Saudi Arabia will strike firmly and decisively if Iran tries to undermine Saudi security. The two countries have traded verbal attacks since July 31st, when Iranian pilgrims were killed during violent demonstrations in the holy city of Mecca. Iran has called on Muslims to overthrow the Saudi ruling family, to seize its oil wealth, and to strip it of its role as the guardian of Muslim holy places. The union and management in South Africa's mine workers' strike met today for the first time since the strike began. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
The mining companies said there should be a meeting without preconditions, and the union agreed. The meeting lasted about 4 hours. While it was going on, about 600 black miners gathered outside in the middle of Johannesburg's plush financial district to demonstrate in support of their demands. Management offered some improvements in death benefits and holiday pay, but made no new offer on the central question of wages, on which the talks broke down before. A union representative said afterwards that the union had offered a compromise wage figure, but he would not disclose it to the press. The two sides agreed that the union will put management's new offer to its members at meetings tomorrow, but it's unlikely that the members will accept it. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
The Canadian government's top mediator met today with the country's striking railway unions and management. William Kelly says this will be the only attempted mediation, and if it fails, the government will intervene to end the strike. Workers walked off the job at midnight Sunday over job security. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 25 points to end the day at 2722.42. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Steve Cropper co-authored some of the great soul songs of the 60s, The Midnight Hour with Wilson Pickett, and Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding. He also played some great guitar licks, but at the time, few recognized his talents or even knew his name. Today, our rock and roll historian Ed Ward pays tribute to Steve Cropper.
I was talking to ZZ Top's guitarist Billy Gibbons the other day about his heroes, and as so often happens with guitar players, the name of Steve Cropper came up. Cropper's not heavy metal, Gibbons said. He's wrought iron. I saw his point immediately. Iron is a very tough substance, but throughout the South, there are people who know how to turn it into something akin to lace. Check out the balconies in the French Quarter of New Orleans, for instance, and see how light and airy it can be. Then find a record with Steve Cropper on it. He's not always up front, like on this Booker T and the MGs recording of Hip Hugger, but when he does come forward, he says what he has to say concisely and with a great deal of authority. Cropper was a railroad man's son from Memphis who fell in with Packy Axton's band, the Royal Spades, in high school. Naturally, with a name like that, you know the band was all white, but they lived for black music. Steve was entranced with the sort of gospel-based guitar style that people like Loman Pauling of the Five Royales played, spare and to the point. The Royal Spades changed their name to the Marquise, and they made a record thanks to the fact that Packy's mom owned Stax Records, but Steve didn't play on their big hit, Last Night. He'd fought with Packy and instead was running Mrs. Axton's record store when he wasn't going to college. But he couldn't stay away from the studio, and one day when he and his friend Booker T. Jones were jamming, they came up with something that sounded pretty good. Green Onions was the start of Booker T and the MGs, which soon became the core of the Stax studio band, once they changed their black bass player, Louis Steinberg, for a white one, Donald Duck Dunn, and made sure their drummer, Al Jackson Jr., was going to stay. During their day, people dismissed Booker T and the MGs because they'd record just about anything, like Ode to Billy Joe or More, but I think they transformed junk into gold. Anyway, a pop song was just an excuse to have some serious fun. Thank you. I'd listen to Steve Cropper play on You Don't Love Me, and suddenly all the debate over whether white boys could play the blues was trivial. It was pretty ironic that during the heyday of the Black Power movement, a lot of the soundtrack was provided by a deeply integrated band. And collaborating with other Stax writers, Cropper was responsible for hits like Eddie Floyd's Knock on Wood and Wilson Pickett's 634-5789, as well as being the guy who performed the immortal guitar intro to Sam and Dave's Soul Man. Lately, Cropper's been performing less and producing more, and unfortunately, his most visible moments recently were with Aykroyd and Belushi's minstrel show, The Blues Brothers. But he's still left a legacy of guitar playing that challenges anybody who'd like to try out the intricacy of wrought iron.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Halliday. He's one of five new poets chosen for publication in the National Poetry Series, which is a collaborative project of five leading publishing houses. Mark Halliday writes in a vernacular style and has been influenced by popular culture as well as by the poets he's read. Before our interview, I asked him to read the title poem from his collection, Little Star. It's inspired by this 1958 hit record by The Elegants.
Where are you, little star?
Little Star, 1. Little Star by The Elegants, 1958, is one of those perfect early rock-pop songs that radiate confidence in a few orderly truths. Above all, if you have the right girl as your girlfriend, you know, the one who walks that way and tosses her hair, the one who dances just a little between cheers at the football game, if you've got her, you're golden. There's nothing else you could wish for. Oh, God, do you remember the golden liquidity of the lead singer's voice as he expresses this shapely truth? He could get it across without needing to rely on the mere meanings of words. He could do everything with golden syllables. Who was he? Can anybody tell me the name of the lead singer for The Elegants? In view of that grand confidence, it would seem a name worth preserving. Really, if you can give me his name, I'll give you $6. I thought of offering 10, but that seems more than I can afford, especially since his name may be fairly easy to discover. $5 nowadays seems paltry, so I'm offering 6. 2. This is not the first time I've tried to get a rock and roll song into a poem, and it won't be the last. It is my need to call out, "This counts too." I don't deny Homer or Virgil or Dante. I'll take your word for it about Bach and Beethoven. I don't question the importance of the Bible, though it never lived in my life. I love Shakespeare and admire Milton as much as you do. But our lives go on in these years, 1958, 1959, 1960, the 60s, and still on in these years like 1977, and still on now, as I write this in September 1980, with the sun bright almost as if new. And we are small. We are postmodern and small, but not therefore worthless. So it is for our sake that I try to insist upon the wafer-thin, gold and value of a certain addition to the long, long, over-talented symphony of culture. Of course, it's no match for some hundreds or even thousands of novels, poems, operas, etc. we could name, nor for 50 rock songs I could name. But I want to say this also was not nothing. 3. Where is he now? The Elegants would be in their 40s now. Is he a vice president of Arista Records? Is he a wise, quiet junkie on the Lower East Side? Is he dead, killed by something that golden syllables can't fix? Or maybe at this moment he sits with another Elegant in a Pizza Hut in L.A. planning the impossible comeback. If you can let me know where he is, I'll send him a fan letter. The unforeseeability of this gesture would make me feel, at least for a day, that a million debts were paid. However, the $6 will be yours for no information more than his name. His name. The point is just to make it true that someone 22 years after a small fact of art can unexpectedly pause and say, "This man sang lead on Little Star."
Did you ever find out the answer to the question, who sang lead on Little Star?
I did find it out. In fact, I have to confess I found it out quite a long time ago. I wrote the poem in 1980. It was published in a small press book in 1981, and right around that time I was informed that the lead singer of the Elegants was a man named Vito Piccone. The Elegants were an Italian group from Staten Island, and Little Star was their only real hit. So I paid the $6, and I kind of thought that maybe I'd written a poem that could never be published again, because I didn't want the gesture in the poem to seem fake. I've included Vito Piccone's name in the acknowledgments page of the book among people that I thank as a way of sort of tipping off sharp-eyed readers that I have learned the guy's name.
You use a lot of vocal group songs in your poems. And, you know, I always thought that one function of pop music was to express the sentiments that we'd be too embarrassed or too shy to express ourselves, especially in love songs. I wonder if you think in a way that songs have taken the role of poetry in putting those sentiments into words.
Well, it's clear that I have very strong feelings about the relation between pop songs, rock and roll songs, and my daily life. In other words, like most of us, I guess, who are anywhere near my age, rock and roll is very deeply in our minds going back to adolescence. So I don't know if this exactly answers your question, but often when I write a poem, a driving impulse is to try to match the evocative quality that I associate with some of these songs.
You know what I think it is, too, in some of those songs? The urgency of the people who sang them, especially like a group from the Elegants, an Italian group from Staten Island, probably working class, has all these dreams of great girlfriends, of making it, probably of getting out of the neighborhood. And even though the lyrics are really corny, like "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder where you are," when you sing it with the kind of urgency that the group does, it starts to mean something beyond the words.
Yeah, I feel that about that song every time I hear it. There's a kind of desperate yearning that the guy gets into his voice.
Would you like your poems to have that kind of urgency that speaks to people the way songs always speak to us?
I have a strong desire to get through to people. Maybe most poets would say that. But I think I'm more willing to risk what many readers would, especially sophisticated readers, would consider banality or obviousness. I'm more willing to risk that for the sake of having an impact and getting through to someone and not seeming like just another formal academic exercise.
One of the things you're doing in your poems is writing in a very colloquial style, speaking in a speech-like way. Did you ever go through a period yourself where you thought that the poetry had to be more formal?
I think ever since I was an undergraduate, I wanted to write poems that were very close to my speaking voice, but they didn't seem very approved by the authority figures that I ran into or read. In 1978, when I was in graduate school, I met the poet Frank Bidart, who was rapidly became then and still is my most important advisor and reader or mentor. And a big thing that he did for me was to give me confidence that a poem could be deeply serious while very colloquial and seemingly conversational in its tone and diction.
I get the impression from some of your poems that sometimes you're overtaken by this sense of futility as a poet, of describing things and of giving your take on things, knowing that there's thousands and thousands of other writers who are in their rooms describing things and delivering their take on things.
Yeah. Yeah, that can be depressing if you become conscious that at any given moment, I mean, right now as we sit here speaking, the typewriters are just going, you know, like a noise, the sound of a million locusts across the land, clacking away. All those poems are coming out. And you can get into a mood where you're really depressed by the fact that no one will have time to read them all.
But obviously poems really do mean a lot to you, poems that you've read and poems that you write. And why does poetry count so much in your life?
Is it because I can't play guitar? Of course, there have been many, many poems for me that have had an effect on my life, maybe as strong. Yeah, I do think in some way as strong as the effect on my life that songs have had. And, you know, I've wanted to recreate that kind of effect, that kind of gathering of significance that I've found in poems.
Mark Halliday, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your poems.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who is co-hosting today's program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry. Tonight we have more information on the U.S. position in Geneva, the arms talks between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in Geneva. The issue is verification, and we're going to find out more. The U.S. has apparently a new position. We're also going to be talking with actual South African miners, John Madison in South Africa, more on the strike there, and Captain America. What happened to Captain America?
Well, what did happen to Captain America?
There's been a little change of personnel. We understand it's nothing serious, but you'll find out all about it tonight on All Things Considered.
Okay, thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic John Leonard has a review of the new book Cloak and Gown by Robin W. Winks. It's an historical look at the connection between Yale men and our country's intelligence organizations, the CIA, and its predecessor, the Office of Strategic Services.
If you think Yale has graduated more than its fair share of spooks, you're right. It all started with Nathan Hale. The first American spy was a Yale man, and it's not surprising that identical statues of him are to be found on Yale's old campus in New Haven and in front of CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. But Yale really got into the spy business up to its armpits during World War II. Professors of history, literature, and economics, and even the crew coach, went undercover themselves or recruited their students to derring do for the OSS. The Yale library was used as a front for a scam in Istanbul. At spy parties in wartime London, even the British joined in singing the Whiffenpoof song. At war's end, some of the daring doers went back to school, but more stayed on to start and staff the CIA, after which departments of anthropology and political science, newspapers and foundations and labor unions were eventually compromised just like the Yale Library. Americans abroad are no longer anywhere considered to be merely tourists. Robin W. Winks, himself a professor of history at Yale and a regular reviewer of spy fiction, wonders what it all means in Cloak and Gown, an ingratiating account of academics on the clandestine, from poor little lambs to black sheep to the occasional big bad wolf. Yale, of course, has always taken its civic responsibility seriously. Most of its children who went off to the covert wars were at worst what Winks calls sentimental imperialists, determined to bring the American message to a messy world by whatever means necessary, including bribery, forgery, fraud, and blackmail. By stopping short in 1961, though, Winks manages not to have to think about political assassination. But a few of those children were very odd birds indeed, and none odder than James Jesus Angleton, to whom Winks turns once he's done exploring the gaudy resentments of the FBI and explaining, yet again, the cleverness of ULTRA, the Nazi code-cracking ring. Before Angleton left Yale for counterintelligence, he was a serious poet. T.S. Eliot was a friend, and Thomas Mann came to lunch. During his years with the CIA, he was known variously, and for good reason, as the poet, mother, orchid, the gray ghost, the cadaver, and the fisherman. Forcibly retired in 1974, he still believed a Soviet mole had penetrated the nation's very cerebellum. He was, in a way, a casualty of the modernist culture of alienation. He had invented his own wasteland, what he called the wilderness of mirrors, in which spies looked at spies looking at spies, and thus made possible the lawless paranoias of a Watergate and an Ollie North. Winks tells some good stories, and he's firm on the crucial difference between historians and intelligence operatives. Historians have to be fair to the evidence. I don't know why he's so easy on Richard Bissell, another Yalie whose dirty tricks embarrassed old pros like Richard Helms and William Colby, nor why he doesn't even mention William F. Buckley Jr., who met E. Howard Hunt in the CIA, nor why he's entirely silent on what the CIA did to Iran and Guatemala in the 1950s. But I do know he's altogether too avuncular. When the counterculture attacked our universities in the 1960s, the universities could hardly pretend they were ivory towers. They had long before been compromised, starting at Yale, in the library, with the poets.
Our book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Cloak and Gown by Robin W. Winks. Here's a look at tomorrow's show. On the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with Phil Tippett. He works in the movies as a stop-motion animator. He brought life to the villainous robot ED-209 in the film RoboCop and the Imperial Walkers in The Empire Strikes Back. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review an album of piano rags written by women and performed by Virginia Eskin. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will share some of the new expressions he heard on a trip through France. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.